I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. More than 13,000 people in Baltimore are living with HIV or AIDS, and the city has the sixth highest rate in the country of people newly diagnosed with HIV. The Baltimore City Health Department just won $20 million in federal grants to target vulnerable populations, gay men and transgender people, and to build partnerships with community groups. We find out more at noon from Dr. Patrick Chalk, Assistant Commissioner for HIV and Sexually Transmitted Diseases. Then Dr. Robert Redfield, an HIV researcher and clinician, tells us why he thinks the city could end its AIDS epidemic. And Kevin Holt, an advocate for the LGBT community, shares how being HIV positive helps him connect with young people who are at risk. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. More than 13,000 people are living with HIV or AIDS in Baltimore. About one in seven, especially young Baltimoreans who are infected, may not be aware of it. They may have avoided getting tested. A bigger worry is that the number of new HIV infections is growing. Late last month, the Baltimore City Health Department announced that it had won $20 million in federal grants for a new strategy to fight the HIV epidemic. The money will be used to target gay men and transgender people because more of them are becoming infected. I want to welcome Dr. Patrick Chalk, Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of HIV and Sexually Transmitted Disease Services at the Baltimore City Health Department. He was the lead investigator on the grant application. Welcome to the show, Dr. Chalk.
Good afternoon, Sheila. Thank you.
HIV is epidemic in Baltimore. The city has the sixth highest rate among all U.S. cities of new HIV diagnoses. Give us a snapshot of HIV in Baltimore.
Well, we have a diagnostic list of about 13,500 people who know they are HIV positive. There are about another 14 to 15% who don't know they're infected. And that's worrisome because those are the people who unknowingly can infect other folks. Most of the new infections the last 3 to 4 years have been among young gay black men. Previously, it used to be among injection drug users. So in 2000, for example, about 60% of the new infections that year were among injection drug users. Last couple of years, it's about 18%. So we attribute that to our syringe exchange program, which gets dirty needles off the street. And this effort is going to be to try and create another strategy like that that really works for gay black men and HIV. We also know that about 50%, 48 to 50% of the people living with HIV as a diagnosis in the city are actually over the age of 50. So most people find that kind of surprising. Most of that, as Bob will tell you, is because our treatment is so effective now that we can let people live much longer and turn it sort of into a chronic disease. So the effort now with this grant and pulling together a broad collaboration of nonprofits and treatment providers is to really take a very integrated and thoughtful approach to providing preventive services for young gay black men and transgenders, as well as linking those who are infected to really effective services.
And I want to ask you more about that, but I want to understand better first why the rate of HIV infection is higher in Baltimore than other cities.
Well, I don't know that. I mean, the rates don't vary that much among the large 10 cities. I mean, the city that's a real outlier is Washington, D.C. It's an extremely high rate there. What you see is it tends to go along with poverty. Poverty loves HIV. And you'll see that if you map out HIV in the city, the cases are predominantly in census tracts where the average income is below the poverty line. Well, why are the young gay men infected? Nobody knows for sure, but the general thinking is after talking with the community and those who we see is that, number one, young gay black men are the least likely to know their HIV status, so they're very unlikely to have been tested for HIV. And if you hang out with friends who have HIV, you're eventually probably going to get it if your relationship is sexual. If they do know their status, they're the least likely to be linked to care. And if they get into care, they're the least likely to actually stay in care. So there's three times along the treatment and diagnosis stage that they tend to fall out of care.
And why for each of those?
I think it's largely a lot of mistrust with the healthcare system historically. Many are uninsured, so they don't have access to counseling and preventive services. There's mistrust of care. There was a study done by two RAND researchers that was published in 2005 that surveyed about 500 African-American people and found that there was a great view that HIV was created by the government. that treatment is being withheld from Black people in particular, that the use of the care is sometimes experimental. So the point of the study in my reading of it is not so much that it's accurate, but if that's the way people believe and perceive the situation, then we have a real challenge with communicating the benefits of prevention and the benefits of effective care.
So in a nutshell, what is your strategy with this new infusion of money?
It's going to be to create a system. It does not cover the medicines. This is to really create a system that's citywide, collaborative of providers and nonprofits that will use social media to get information out to the target populations. We will be recruiting people from those communities to be part of this. In other words, they're not going to volunteer. We're actually going to reach out and try and hire people from the young gay Black community and the transgender community. We have the opportunity to create about 65 new full-time jobs with this work across all the across all the participants. So for us, I think it's an opportunity to say, we want you to be part of this solution. We want you to help guide us and make sure that we don't inadvertently make this more stigmatizing than it already is.
Just last week, the World Health Organization issued new guidance about treating AIDS with antiretroviral drugs. Dan Roderick spoke about the coming change with Dr. Chris Beyrer, who's director of the Johns Hopkins Training Program in HIV Epidemiology and Prevention Science, and the associate director of the Center for Global Health at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Beyrer had just returned from an international HIV/AIDS conference in Vancouver.
But the big news was, and really very important news, was the evidence from the START trial, a 36-country study, which showed that early treatment really is better and reduced the number of clinical events like a hospitalization or an AIDS-related infection or cancer by over 50%. So the message really is that as soon as people are diagnosed with HIV, they need to be offered therapy. And in many developing countries, they're still using old guidelines where, for example, you have to have below a certain immune threshold. That's very dangerous. The WHO, the World Health Organization, is going to change its recommendations based on this new science. That's going to happen in the next few months. And that's going to mean that something like 22 million people worldwide are going to be now eligible to start antiviral therapy.
So that's the news from the World Health Organization. Treat as soon as there's a diagnosis. But Dr. Chalk, am I right that Baltimore is planning to go beyond that, beyond early treatment to preventive treatment?
Yeah, we do test and treat, which is what Chris was referring to right now. We are fortunate in that our health department, when it gives people their test results, we actually take them to care that very day. In other words, we don't give them a cab fare. We don't give them a referral. We actually take them to care, and then we take them home. And we provide a second visit to the clinicians about 3 months later when there's follow-up work to be done. And the point of that is to emphasize the importance of getting into care early and getting on treatment right away. Bob's done a lot of work in Africa on this, and I'm sure he'll want to say some words of this, but we're moving from treatment to the preventive side now. So we want to work on the people who are HIV negative and provide care, which is basically PrEP, which is a strategy. It's not just a drug. It's a program around behavior, sexual attitudes, and then getting on medicine that will prevent you from getting infected. And most of the studies show very, very good effectiveness with it. And Kaiser published a study just this last September talking about roughly 500 people in their system that were on PrEP, and over the course of 2 years, not one got infected with HIV.
You've made a couple of references to Bob, so let me divulge to our listeners that Dr. Robert Redfield is here with us in the studio. He's co-founder of the Institute for Human Virology at the University of Maryland Medical School. He's both a researcher and a clinician, and full disclosure, I serve on the Institute's advisory board. Dr. Redfield, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sheila.
And why is early treatment or even preventive treatment powerful?
Well, the virus that causes AIDS and HIV infection, it's an infection. And the way it goes from one person to the other depends on how much virus the person who's infected has. So one of the first and foremost ways to limit the spread of HIV infection is to get people on treatment now that we have effective treatment. Because once you get people that are infected on effective treatment, their viral load goes down and they become really non-infectious for all practical purposes. There's a number of studies that's shown in discordant couples. if you get the viral load below a certain threshold, there's no transmission among discordant couples.
Discordant couples sounds like people...
Yeah.
These are unhappy married people?
No, what is this? They're very happy. Where one person's HIV infected and one person isn't HIV infected.
Gotcha.
The original work was done by Tom Quinn back in 2000, published in the New England Journal, showed that if they got their viral load under 1,500 copies, that person did not transmit. And that's at a time when we didn't have totally effective therapy. Now, fast forward 15 years, we have totally effective therapy. We can get the viral load in a range that we can't even detect it anymore. And when you do that, transmission really does stop. So the first thing is to diagnose.
So people still have the virus.
Still have the virus.
They still need to be on treatment.
They still need to be on treatment. But the first thing is, as Patrick said, is to get people diagnosed, get them linked to care, get them to stay in care, and then get them on treatment. And have that treatment done in a way that is effective to reduce that viral load to be undetectable. And we have all the tools to do that. The challenge in the United States has been, I think, the willingness to develop programs that are comprehensive that can implement that.
Well, you have, as Dr. Chalk mentioned, you have actually not just observed this but made this happen in some African countries. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, a number of years ago, President Bush, as I like to say, saw the possible and led a nation to act. He saw the possible that AIDS therapy could have an impact on survival and the AIDS epidemic in Africa, and called on Congress to give originally $15 billion and set up a program we call the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief. And
PEPFAR.
And we were one of those original recipients and had the opportunity to try to implement this in a number of African countries and Caribbean countries. At the end of the day, we put about 700,000 people into care and treatment. And I do try to stress this as Patrick and I talk about opportunities for Baltimore and Maryland. In Africa today, the incidence of new infection is actually going down. In America today, the incidence isn't changing. Hasn't changed in the last 10 to 15 years. In Africa, the life expectancy is now going up. In some countries, like one I recently received a grant in CDC for Botswana, Botswana right now has about 65% of the people living with HIV infection in Botswana are already on treatment, and a majority of them are suppressed. I think if Patrick and I were to say probably Maryland's numbers, we would probably say maybe 30% of people living with HIV infection in Maryland are suppressed, but in Botswana, it's double that. So, again, part of this comes down, and this is why the program that Patrick's leading is so important. It's not about new discovery. We have all the tools we need to end the AIDS epidemic in America. Those tools are we need to diagnose people, and we've done really much better in the last couple of years. I would argue we're probably about 88% of people living with HIV in America are diagnosed. But there are exceptions. Between 13 and 29-year-olds, it's probably only 40%. So we have a lot of room to do there. Linking to care, it's critical. And as Patrick said, he started a program that we got to be part of called Connect to Care. In the old days, we would tell you you're infected at a diagnostic center, and we would schedule you an appointment in 6 to 8 weeks, telling you it was very important. And guess what? 60% of people would never show up for the appointment.
Mm-hmm.
So Patrick, the city of Baltimore, they got to work with our people in the JOCS Initiative and other people in the city, set up a program we call Connect to Care. You're diagnosed, and you're immediately connected to care because we believe it's really important that you get into care, and it sends a whole different message. And once you're connected to care, you need the tools to keep people in care. The simple thing is how to treat the disease. We know how to do that now. We can teach general practitioners how to be highly successful. The problem is we don't get people connected and able to stay in care. And it's strictly just an implementation problem. It's not a science problem. It's an implementation problem.
That's Dr. Robert Redfield of the University of Maryland School of Medicine's Institute on Human Virology. This is Midday. Also with us is Dr. Patrick Chalk from the City of Baltimore's Health Department. We're going to take a short break. You can be part of this conversation, and we hope you will be. You can call us at 410-662-8000. 8780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. When we come back, we are going to meet a community advocate who's using his personal story to encourage young people to get tested, to know their status, to get connected to care. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore has one of the worst HIV/AIDS epidemic in the U.S. In this hour, we're speaking with Dr. Patrick Chalk, Assistant Commissioner for HIV and Sexually Transmitted Diseases at the Baltimore City Health Department. We're talking to him about the $20 million in federal grants that the city recently won. And also with us in Studio A is Dr. Robert Redfield, scientist, researcher, clinician, co-founder of the Institute for Human Virology at the University of Maryland Medical School. Dr. Chalk, you said there were some points about testing that we hadn't brought out yet.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what Bob had already referred to about the importance of getting testing and knowing your HIV status. Historically, we've usually used targeted testing. In other words, we pick people in places to make sure that we do outreach and provide free tests for them. But recommendations from the CDC and the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force are now recommending, and have for about a year or so, and certainly with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, providing HIV testing as part of the routine medical care in the primary care setting. So to help do that, we are working with Maryland, Johns Hopkins, and MICA. Over the past 4 years, we've created a project called Protect Baltimore, which is specifically targeting private physicians and their practices. And we are copying from the pharmaceutical company detailing. So we have public health detailers that go out to the private offices and provide them a kit that explains everything they need to know about HIV, about tests and how to interpret it, and then how to bill for the service. And so we're focused primarily at this point in time on what we consider the high transmission areas in the city of Baltimore. And that's about half the census tracts, unfortunately, for the city. But this is to try and get HIV testing as part of the routine healthcare encounter so that it doesn't mean that we're testing you because we think you're at risk. We're testing you because it's common for us to be doing that. It should be part of you knowing your HIV status. And that's turning up new HIV infections among people we never would have predicted.
And I understand that in this grant, these grants that you've gotten, the City Health Department will be partnering with local care providers and with community organizations. Can you tell me a bit about how these groups will be using the money, what they'll be doing?
It'll be to build infrastructure in the groups, and I'd identify them for you now, except we're still in the process of negotiating contracts and budgets, but which is always the case. But I think we've identified sort of the key players. There's about 11 of us together, and then we're going to also issue an RFP so that we can bring in a handful of small community organizations that can connect the work to some of the communities throughout the city. So this is not intended to be a health department project only. It's really the city project, and we're trying to pull everybody in a way that we really haven't been able to do in the past. So this will help build some of their infrastructure. It will work to coordinate care, doing referrals, adding some staff that are needed, like peer navigators, which are people from the community who will help people that are at risk to get treated get into care. So it's a multifaceted approach.
Dr. Redfield.
I just wanted to add one other thing in response about what is needed and what's so important about this project that Patrick's leading. We now know also that not only treating the HIV-infected person is critical to reduce what we call the community viral load and make it less likely for the virus to be transmitted, but we also know that if you're continued to be at risk for HIV infection, you can also take medicine that will prevent you from becoming infected. So that despite having 30 years of attempts to change behavior, we still have people that put themselves at risk. We now have a biological mechanism, taking what we call pre-exposure prophylaxis, that will prevent them from acquiring infected.
Pre-exposure prophylaxis, essentially preventive, taking medicines preventively.
Yeah. Similar to what you would do if you were going to a malaria area. We now know that if you're someone at high risk, particularly if you're a man who has sex with men in some of the zip codes in our city, that it's really critical for us to reach out to you, create a clinical environment that you will negotiate successfully and come in and get access to pre-exposure prophylaxis so you won't be infected. The WHO not only recommended treating everybody last week, But the other thing that I think was so important, they also recommended for the first time, if you're at high risk, if you're at high risk for HIV infection, you should now be offered pre-exposure prophylaxis. Pre-exposure prophylaxis will keep new people from becoming infected, and treatment of people who are already infected will keep those individuals from transmitting. And this is why I say to you, Sheila, we have the tools to end the AIDS epidemic in America. I mean, I hope that we create a successful AIDS vaccine. I think to end the epidemic in the world, we probably need an AIDS vaccine. But to end the AIDS epidemic in America, we just have to implement what we already have.
That's Dr. Robert Redfield from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, Institute on Human Virology, here on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Dr. Patrick Chalk from the Baltimore City Health Department. You can be part of this conversation. Send us an email at midday@wipr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. And I'd like to pull into the conversation Kevin Holt, who is Outreach Director for the GLCCB, the GLBT Community Center for Baltimore and Central Maryland. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
And I gather, even though Dr. Chalk says details are still being worked out, that you expect to be one of the organizations involved in this effort.
Yes, I am.
How did you get involved in outreach to the GLBT community?
In 2004, I found out that I was HIV positive and didn't really know about HIV at all. And I didn't have people that actually talked to me about it and didn't have a good support system.
You were how old then?
I'm 33 years old now.
So that was 11 years ago.
Yes. And I went out looking for help and looking for information and education. And I didn't want no other young person like myself to go through the same thing I went through. Because of me finding out, I went through high school, people not wanting to deal with me, lived on the streets for 2 years because I really didn't want to take the medication. I didn't want to go to the doctors. And I actually had my uncle who was positive too, to say one of two things: you can live or die. Which one you wanted to do. And at that point, I made it in my mind that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to help other people to get the education about this.
So what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
I listen to the community. That's my day-to-day basis, is I go out and I talk to the community, especially with the LGBT community, especially with our young people. They want to see somebody that they can actually approach and talk to. And we're not judge them for asking questions. And so I go out to the clubs. I go out walking down the streets, what we like, people like to call the, they call it, the young people call the meat rack, where the street walkers walk, and have conversations with them and say there is places that you can go and be who you are and be safe and get education about HIV and get tested. A lot of them are afraid to go into clinics because they don't want to be judged. A lot of them are afraid to go into shelters because they don't want to be judged. So my job is to really be that person to say, okay, I can go with you. I can be beside you when you go through this. Even when they become positive, I want to be that person to say, okay, let's go get tested. If you come up positive, let's go to get treatment.
That's where I feel.
I want to emphasize what Kevin said, because once people are infected, there is opportunities for them to figure out how to negotiate the health system for that question, because we have effective treatment. But what I want to stress is the importance of creating the environment that's safe for the people to seek the care when they're not infected. Non-infected individuals that are putting themselves at risk for HIV infection need a non-judgmental environment to get the treatment that we now know works. They also need a mechanism to afford that treatment. It's another challenge we have. Pre-exposure prophylaxis works, but it costs probably around $1,000 a month, okay? But it works. And so I really think one of the things Patrick and the city were trying to do with this project, but broader for the United States, is we need to create an environment that allows people to feel comfortable to come in, acknowledge their risk, and be treated in a non-judgmental way. And you can see why that's hard, because for 30 years, we argued you should change your behavior, you should change your behavior, you should change your behavior. Now I want to basically keep you from being infected by at least being effectively treated.
Kevin, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. When you have doctors that are non-judgeable when you walk in, or actually people who are case managers or outreach workers like myself are not going to judge you for what you're doing in your life, then that makes you say, okay, yeah, I can go and get help. I can go and do this. And you have right now with this whole collaborate, we are all here to basically do that work. We're not here to judge you. We want you to come in and we want you to get your help that you need. We want you to be safe. We want you to live. That's the whole point about this, is for you to live your life to the fullest. And that's why I'm so happy to be a part of this myself.
Let me follow up, Dr. Redfield, since you raised the issue of cost. Dr. Chalk, I believe you said a few minutes ago that this grant money is not to pay for medicines.
Correct.
So is cost going to be a barrier to doing cost to the
co-pays
patient?
Will probably be an issue. Right now, Medicaid covers PrEP and the work that goes with it.
PrEP being the
program.
Preventive, yeah. The preventive.
It covers the drug, and some of the private payers pay for it as well. But a lot of the people that we're talking about here are not insured, even though they're eligible. So part of this is going to have to be to get people into an insurance mechanism to begin to pay for this. And even co-pays, if they're small, will be a barrier. They don't have to be big. If you're sort of living on the margins and have unstable employment, unstable housing, you don't have the money to be able to do this. So our real concern here is that this doesn't become yet another racial wedge where we make it worse for minorities than it already is. I've sort of said that this is really as much about social and racial justice as it is about HIV. And we want to make sure that people who are, for example, the target of this, young gay black men and transgenders who have not had access to a lot of care, will find that they will get access from the work that we're going to do. So that's a big focus, because this could backfire if we're not careful and really make things even more inequitable. Yeah. You know, right now, 64% of the people living in Baltimore are African American. 85% of the people living with HIV are African American. That's a real racial disparity.
And just to go thinking forward on the cost issue, I always say you need to spend money to save money. Maryland is around 2,000 to 2,200 new infections per year right now. We have the tools to eliminate those infections if we choose to use them. Conservatively, it's going to cost at least $500,000 for each patient.
This is the lifetime
cost
of treatment.
So every year we're adding $1 billion, largely to our public health cost, because a lot of these patients are going to be paid by public systems. So to me, if I can spend money now to knock off that $1 billion of new expenses, it makes no sense that we're not aggressive in doing this. And working to develop those mechanisms to allow people to be able to be effectively treated with pre-exposure prophylaxis while they put themselves at risk. And that includes men who have sex with men, but it also includes injection drug users. Mm-hmm. It includes people that have, you know, multiple sexual partners. It includes people that are in what I call discordant couples. We could eliminate transmission. But instead, our state has around 2,000 to 2,200 new infections per year. And if you just multiply, it's probably closer to 650,000, but I use 500,000. That's $1 billion. And most of that's going to be in populations that are paid for by Medicare, Medicaid, or are uninsured.
If you'd like to be part of this conversation about how Baltimore is addressing the AIDS epidemic in Baltimore, its new strategy, give us a call at 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Michael from Baltimore has called us. Michael, welcome to Midday.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I have a question. I was wondering if you can contract HIV through oral sex.
Thanks for the question. Who wants to address it?
You certainly can. I mean, it's you can't. I actually saw a study that was done just only a couple years ago, and people still believe that you can get HIV from drinking out of a glass that someone has drunk with. So we have a huge stigma issue that we're going to have to deal with. And I would like to see that one of the leave behinds by this initiative is that we've normalized conversation about sex. We still haven't achieved that yet. And I think that's one of the big barriers that's getting in our way.
Thank you, Michael, for the call. Karen in Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello.
I've been a nurse for almost 40 years. I graduated in the late 70s, and so I was around for the beginning of HIV when it was this awful, still an awful disease, but it was a mysterious disease, and everybody was afraid. And, you know, I've just seen amazing things in my career as a nurse. And I do want to say a lot of it is because it upsets me a little bit when I hear this thing about how the black community doesn't trust the medical establishment. I know medical history. I understand that. But so many doctors and so many nurses have worked so hard to try to make this thing better up to this day. I work in one of the large teaching hospitals downtown, and I'm an oncology nurse. And what I see is the end effect of people not getting treatment, and then they get, like, HIV lymphomas and things like that, which is horrendously expensive to treat. And in our society, guess what? If you show up in the ER and you're really, really sick with something like that, you're going to get treated no matter who you are. And I treat all my patients the same, and the doctors treat all their patients the same. Now, having said that, I am so in favor for this program because, like they say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I'd much rather spend the money up front and help people not get infected, or if they get infected, get treated effectively, than have you end up in my unit where, you know, there's a lot of suffering and it's going to be hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars. So I really hope that this program will be successful.
Karen, I appreciate your calling. Kevin?
Yeah, and I understand where she's coming from. And I'm not saying all doctors and all nurses, because I've been in hospitals here in Baltimore and in Richmond, Virginia, where the nurses and the doctors have been wonderful and very concerned about your health and very concerned about how comfortable you are talking to them. And I'm just saying that there are some doctors that I and nurses that I know in the medical field and providers that need some more training in this, especially with the LGBTQ community. And that's all I'm not saying. I'm not saying everybody is that way. You have some who are very, very compassionate.
And I just want to add something just to what Karen said, because she's seen it, and nothing's more complicated than taking care of an HIV-infected patient that has, say, lymphoma. Today, the second leading cause of death for HIV patients is actually the cancers. And lymphoma is a good example. One of the ways that I can prevent you from getting lymphoma, particularly non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, is if I treat you. So once you've been
you for AIDS.
HIV. So once I've treated you and the viral load suppressed for more than 2 years, the incidence of lymphoma goes back to background. So it's and as she said, not only is it complicated, not only is it difficult, not only is it costly. Early treatment can actually prevent a lot of these comorbidities. But again, we can only do early treatment if we get people diagnosed, get them into care, get them linked in care, and get them staying care.
Karen, I just want to thank you for your comments. And I think I said when I was talking about that the importance of the study was not that it proved what people were believing. It's just that was their belief. And if that is their belief, it's going to drive their healthcare-seeking behavior. So I was trying to get to the point that we really want to make sure that we destigmatize all of this and make
destigmatize
and make it easier for the healthcare providers to actually do their job. Certainly among the transgender community, there's a real access to appropriate care for that population. You will constantly hear from them that they can't find a provider who knows, not that they don't care, they just don't know how to take care of transgenders. And so I think that will be woven into this work as well. So we have a lot to do, but we have a lot of opportunity.
Karen, thank you so much for your call. We have to take another short break here. When we come back, more about fighting the spread of HIV in Baltimore. What are the barriers to treatment? How do we combat the stigma that we have been talking about? You can be part of the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. Stay with us. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the AIDS epidemic in Baltimore and what the city is doing to address it, its new strategy. I'm speaking with Dr. Patrick Chalk of the Baltimore City Health Department, Dr. Robert Redfield, co-founder of the Institute for Human Virology at the University of Maryland Medical School, and Kevin Holt, outreach coordinator for the GLCCB, a nonprofit community center for the GLTB community. Kevin, did you have, in your experience, issues getting into care and sticking with it?
Yes, I did. When I first got diagnosed, believe it or not, I had really ready to do a suicide when I first found out, because I didn't believe it could happen to me, because one, I didn't have the education for it. When I got diagnosed, the hospital that I got diagnosed, it was in Richmond, Virginia, and they had an actual HIV clinic in the hospital, and the doctor actually came up and talked to me at that point. Said, well, we needed to be on medication. I don't like taking pills. I never did like taking pills, and I can be upfront about it now. But at that time, it was other issues I was dealing with than just HIV. And I did not want to take pills. I was homeless at the time when I found out. I'm a former foster child. I just came out being gay. My foster parents didn't want to deal with it. So why would I want to just take a pill? Why was I worried about HIV? I always thought it was a death sentence. So it wasn't no point for me to take it at that time.
You thought it was futile.
It was just, I was worried about where I was going to put my head, what shelter that I had, where I was going to find money. That was all I was worried about at that particular time. Again, my uncle, who was positive, he came in and basically started dealing with me. And when he did that, then I started listening to the doctors. Then I started to really start taking care of myself. It's been a battle. It's not, just a snap finger that I just jumped in and said, okay, I'm doing this. No, it's been a battle. I had to learn I had to take this medication at this time. I had to go see this doctor at this time. I had to, I do need to find shelter and get a job and do everything every single day. But I also know my health was important at that point. And that's when my support system came into play. That's when the case managers came into play. That's when these peer navigators that we're going to have come into play. With PrEP, HIV, anything you do in life, when you have that support system, that changed your mindset to do what you have to do to stay healthy. And that's what my mindset had to change, because the only thing I was worried about at that time, I was homeless. I was living on the streets. I was doing things that you wouldn't even believe now that I did back then. And I'm not ashamed of what I did back then, because that's made me stronger now to do the work that I'm doing now. Because some young person can come to me and say, well, I'm living on the streets and I have to do this. Okay, I'm not judging you because I've been where you've been.
That's Kevin Holt, Outreach Coordinator for the GLCCB, a nonprofit community center for the GLTB community. If you'd like to talk to Kevin or to Dr. Robert Redfield from the University of Maryland Medical School or to Dr. Patrick Chalk of the City of Baltimore Health Department, you can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who was curious about what we're all calling PrEP here, which stands for exactly what, Dr. Chalk?
Pre-existing prophylaxis.
Pre-existing prophylaxis. And they wanted more detail about exactly how it's going to work.
Well, it's, again, Bob can join me on this and answer. It's not a drug only. It's a program. It's designed to enable people to take a combination antiviral pill that, if taken on essentially a daily basis, will prevent 90 to 95% infection from HIV exposure. You are still really recommended to reduce your partners. It's not a free ticket to go do whatever what you want to do sexually in the community. But it does really reduce the risk, and in particular, if you combine it with those who are in treatment, as Bob said, the effectiveness of our current drugs are quite miraculous. We can really reduce the viral load in patients to undetectable if they adhere to their medications and are put on the right medications. So as Bob was saying, we really have the tools at our disposal now to deal both prevention effectively and suppression effectively. So
Are there concerns that people involved in PrEP will stop using condoms?
Well, that's always an issue. And we're certainly seeing in some studies that there's some sexually transmitted infections that occur among these people. But even then, The transmission is still going to be extremely, extremely low. I don't know what the condom use has been.
I mean, there's done studies, Sheila, that are a number of them now where they intentionally enrolled people that had unprotected rectal intercourse in the presence of pre-exposure prophylaxis, and there was not transmission. So I think we have biological solutions, right? Doesn't mean we don't want to still, you know, help people have behavioral changes that may be a benefit to them. But again, from my point of view, we have biological solutions. I want to emphasize what Kevin says, because there's a tendency for people to believe we need health navigators and case managers for people that are HIV infected to be successful in their treatment so they can live a natural lifetime. But we also need the same for people that are at risk. Mm-hmm. We need to engage people at risk with a continuity of care so that they stay in continuity of care to be able to basically effectively take pre-exposure prophylaxis. The only other thing I'll add about pre-exposure prophylaxis, in order for it to work, you have to consistently take it. Mm-hmm. There is a new drug that's being developed.
And you just said take it, which is what somebody says about a drug, and yet Dr. Chalk has been stressing to us that it's a approach to life. It's
right.
Not a drug.
Well, because I think we all want to still encourage the other approach to life, but what I'm trying to say, strictly as a clinical researcher, the biology of taking Truvada, tenofovir, and another drug that we call FTC, taking those two drugs together, the bottom line is they work. And in a population of people at risk for HIV infection where those that are infected are also suppressed, there will not be any significant epidemic HIV transmission.
Okay. What do you mean by risky? Because I can imagine what I might consider risky behavior,
somebody else
might think is normal, or vice versa.
For me, clinically, risk behavior would be having sexual intimacy or sharing blood or blood products, you know, IV drug use, with someone who's infected or has a high probability of being infected. Now, these gentlemen may want to comment differently, so that it really, we're talking about risk of HIV acquisition. So central to that is exposure to HIV.
Kevin, how do you tell if somebody is engaging in risky behavior?
As being an outreach and also being an HIV tester, if somebody comes in and says that I have multiple partners, then a red flag goes off in my head saying, okay, this person is at risk. Because that means that you're not using condoms, or you're just going to partner to partner to partner, and you're not with one person. Now, another risk thing is, for me, is you come in and say, my partner is positive, and you're supposedly negative, and you want to take a test. Then that's a risk factor to me, because you're in a committed relationship. Now, the other question I'm going to ask, is your partner suppressed? And if you say no, then that's a risk factor for me.
And your partner would know if he or she is suppressed by
the doctor,
a blood test.
By the blood test by your doctor,
okay.
By their doctor.
We had some callers who could not stay with us who had questions about how, as I recall, the question was how long before you notice HIV symptoms, or how soon after exposure do you see HIV symptoms? And another question was, how long are you in PrEP before it takes effect?
Well, I think in terms of the once you're exposed to HIV infection, the truth is there's new tests now that we're using that are combination tests of detecting what the antibody that you develop to HIV, which was the old test that diagnosed it and usually took 6 to 12 weeks to be positive. But it also includes an antigen test, so it's a combined test. So pretty much, I'd say within, 2 to 4 weeks, if you've been exposed, you'll have a positive test by these tests. Now, you may not have any symptoms whatsoever. I mean, this was the challenge the AIDS virus was. We had patients that were infected, and it was 8, 9, 10 years later is when they presented with symptoms. But we have the tools to diagnose it.
Hold on,
probably within 2 to 4 weeks.
Kevin's trying to get
I didn't have no symptoms a year later. I didn't have no symptoms at all. And
so
then I got really sick, and I had to go into the hospital for a month and a half. And that's how I found out.
Okay.
Your question about how long you have to take PrEP, I think, is still being more accurately defined. In general, to get what we call the levels of the drugs in your cells to the level that we have been associated with protection, it's probably close to 3 to 4 weeks. Although there are some studies that show taking medicine after exposure has worked, I think the jury's still out. Right now, I would argue it probably takes 2 to 4 weeks of taking the medicine before I feel you have a high probability of protection.
I'd like to pull Jan from Baltimore into this conversation. Jan?
Yes, hello.
Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. My question is, for those who have no symptoms and whose test numbers are not showing anything, what is the ethical responsibility of that person in terms of relationships with other partners?
Who wants to address that? Jan, thanks for the call.
Myself is, you need to tell the person that you're actually with. Disclose to that person. If you know that you're with that person and you're in a committed relationship with the person, you need to have that conversation with them. And it's very hard. It's not easy to have that conversation at all with anybody, family members, coming out, anything like that. But you really need to give that person the choice to say, okay, yes, I can deal with this. Because if that person is in a committed relationship with you, they need to know and they need to have that choice.
Jan, does that give you?
Well, yes. And if the person is not in a committed relationship with someone, that even makes it more complicated.
Yes, it does. But they still need to let that person know.
So committed relationship or not, if you're with
somebody, you need to let that person know.
You need to share. Jan, thanks for the call. Mark in Falston, welcome to Midday.
Mark? Hi. I just wanted to thank you all. This is an incredible program that's long been needed, and I think it can be really successful. I'm a 54-year-old gay male who has been out since I was 19. I'm HIV negative and have been and plan to stay that way. I've been in a committed relationship for the last 23 years, legally married for the last two. I think it's important to continue to educate people about the stigma that we have around being LGBT or at risk in other areas. I've worked with lesbian, gay, bi, transgender people for the last 20 years. I've lost over 40 people, friends and loved ones, to HIV/AIDS. And I think it's important that we not only educate young people, but also their family and also their church members. I know a lot of people who have lost their church families because they've been found out as being gay. And we're all part of one human family. And I think that's really important that we get that message across to people. Whether we're LGBT or G or Q or I, we're all part of one human family. And I think we need to learn the message of love. And that's really important. So keep up the good work, Kevin, and everybody. You guys are doing incredible work, and this is much needed. So,
Mark, thanks. Thanks for the call, Mark.
Can I comment? And he makes a point with the faith community. We do need to get in that community. And that's been my number one thing, is to talk to those leaders to have that conversation in their churches.
And is that part of your strategy, Dr. Chell?
Yes, and I would say that actually the religious community is actually starting to turn around in Baltimore. I think that's really important. I think there's 1,800 churches in this city, and some of them are represented in our city HIV commission, and we have a faith work group on the commission that's trying to engage the pastors. So we hold our HIV meetings at a church whenever we have it, partly because the parking's free, but also it's big and it's a way to engage the church. There's a number of pastors in town here who are really leaders on the issue of HIV. So I would say 20 years ago, it was a huge challenge for us, but it's starting to turn around. And that's going to be important because they can be really strong messengers to their parishioners on this issue and really create that sort of city groundswell that we're going to need to turn this around.
Let me echo what our caller Mark said, thanking you all for this hour. It's been very, very enlightening, I think. Dr. Patrick Chalk, Assistant Commissioner for the Bureau of HIV-STD Services at the Baltimore City Health Department. Dr. Robert Redfield, co-founder of the Institute for Human Virology at the University of Maryland Medical School. And Kevin Holt, Outreach Coordinator for the GLTV Community Center of Baltimore and Central Maryland. Lunch for today's Midday Guest was provided by Chaparelli's in Little Italy. In business since 1940, Chaparelli serves soup, salad, pizza, seafood, and pasta. Available for dine-in, carry-out, or catering, Chaparelli's is located at 237 South High Street. Tomorrow on Midday, tune in at noon for a look at European refugee crisis. We'll hear about the efforts of two local nonprofits to find homes in Germany and in Baltimore for refugees. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon. Come back again tomorrow.